have some students from Stockbridge High School, and if those notes are correct, would they and their faculty advisors please stand? Very good. Thank you so much for coming. We like to have students visit us. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that the Supreme Court maintains with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. They receive some information about the matters that they will hear, and then when there is a conclusion of the morning session, which will be after this case, one of the justices comes down and speaks with the student, not about the substance of the case, but just about how matters proceed through the Supreme Court, how they get here, and other matters of procedure. Today it is I who will visit with you all and anybody else who cares to stay after the conclusion of this case. Now, we have taken a look at you a little bit, and now I'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Michael Gabelman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to him, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to me, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler, and on the far left, Justice Rebecca Bradley. With those introductions taken care of, we will now begin with OLR versus Gotsky. Are you prepared to begin, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Terry Johnson. I appear on behalf of the respondent, James Gotsky. Despite the many factual issues in the case, despite all the briefs that have been filed, I believe this case and its resolution turns upon one simple factual and legal question, and that is, how does the court apply to this case, under the facts, its rule that says that it applies the standard of determining whether the findings of fact by the referee are clearly erroneous? In this case, the referee made a number of findings, finding that the evidence sustained by evidence which is clear, convincing, and satisfactory, that Mr. Gotsky behaved dishonestly in a number of respects. Mr. Gotsky has never argued that he did not violate rules. Mr. Gotsky has said from the beginning, it is clear in the hearing testimony, it is clear from our answer, Mr. Gotsky had done a very poor job of running his trust account, that he was uninformed at best, ignorant at worst of some of the trust account rules, and that he had made a series of mistakes. Mr. Gotsky has said from the beginning that he deserves discipline for that, and we have asked this court to discipline him for that. The fundamental difference from the beginning between the position that the OLR has taken and the position we have taken is whether Mr. Gotsky not only made mistakes, but that he intended dishonestly to take advantage of a client.
When you say you've acknowledged that he has had violations for which there should be discipline, I have a list of the counts which I think that you have conceded as violations, but I'd rather get the list from you if you have it.
I think I have it accurately, but I may not. I believe the ones which have been conceded for sure are counts 2, 3, 7, 12, 14, 15, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 30, 31, 38, 42, 39, 42, and 48.
Not 48. There aren't what's the last one you gave?
48. 45, I'm sorry.
There's only 45.
My failing eyesight. I should get
you
these printed.
You can use these if you need any help.
I'm not sure. I need to get them printed bigger. But with all due respect to the question, Justice Bradley, I don't think that's the real question, because it doesn't really matter which counts involve dishonesty as opposed to which counts don't. What matters is, ultimately, is the conclusion that the referee reached that Mr. Gotsky was dishonest in an overall sense supported by the evidence. And that's important not just for whatever counts you find are sustained, but it's more important in determining what the discipline is. Because I think there's a fairly obvious and necessary bright line rule that says we treat lawyers who violate the rules through, for want of a better word, sloppiness, far, far differently, no matter how many violations they've had, then we treat lawyers who behave dishonestly, no matter how few or how many violations they have. And it should be so.
You, in my opinion, hit the nail on the head, or one of the nails on the head, in starting out with the findings of fact of the referee. As a reviewing court, it is hard to show that a finding is clearly erroneous.
It is.
That it violates the facts of record or it violates the law. Yep. And so you've got an uphill battle. Tell me why you have succeeded in this uphill battle.
I have succeeded because of the encouragement given by the profoundly disappointing personally decision in the Balestrieri case. Because in the Balestrieri case, this court did what I thought it did not do. I thought it did not go back and evaluate the evidence. I have been telling clients in the work I've done in this area for many, many years that if we lose on findings with the referee, we're essentially dead in the water. If we win, we win.
The record should reflect I dissented in
this
case.
Yes. It's one of the reasons I thought it would be appropriate to bring it up with you.
Okay.
I mean no criticism of the court in saying that. We have our disagreement with that decision. It's the law. We accept it. Mr. Balestrieri accepts it. But the Balestrieri case shows that this court does not simply accept without examination factual findings made by the referee. That there is, although in most instances that evaluation apparently results in an acceptance of those findings because the rules are, and the decisions of this court are heavily slanted in favor of accepting them, it is not a blind, we don't look at this. Balestrieri says we do look at this. And so now I say, let's look at this. Here's the evidence. Mr. Gatzke freely admitted from the very beginning on all occasions what he did wrong. Mr. Gatzke was never substantially impeached by anyone about anything.
And counsel, just so I'm clear on what the different positions are of the different parties, is it your client's position that he entered into the investment relationship with his former client?
Schaefer, yes.
Yes. And that he took the money, invested it in various real estate projects, and due to the timing of the real estate market and the collapse of value, that those investments started to lose money.
I would agree with, in essence, everything you said except took the money. I would say, with the consent of the client, the money was invested in the real estate investment. I didn't mean to say you were meant pejoratively, but I want to make sure
you don't mean converted the money to his own use. They invested. The intent seems to be that they were going to, the undisputed intent seems to be that they agreed to enter into different investments. Ms. Schaefer had indicated that she was aware of Mr. Gatzke's prior success in different real estate ventures. When the value of the land started to go down, He had to still pay the bills, and he did shift money from different trust accounts, but as I understand it, nobody is out any money except for the investors. Is this all accurate so far?
That is our position as to what the evidence shows, yes.
Has there been any civil lawsuit filed against your client in connection with the Schaefer matter?
The only civil lawsuit that was filed was, I believe there was a foreclosure action with regard to the mortgage on the condominium project. That was the main investment involved here. I'm not clear on that. My client testified that, as a result, the interest in the condominium association, the condominium development, was surrendered to the bank, and he ended up with a judgment, a sizable judgment. I believe it's $100,000. It is a fact of record in the testimony.
My question was actually, has Ms. Schaefer sued your client?
No, Ms. Schaefer has not sued. That's the only lawsuit, if there was a foreclosure lawsuit. I think there was.
What is your client's position on restitution?
My client's position on restitution, as expressed in our brief, is that once a proper understanding of what happened occurs, Ms. Schaefer is not entitled to restitution. Her daughter may be entitled to a remedy against Ms. Schaefer and Mr. Gatzke, but that for the reasons cited in our brief, it would be inappropriate to order restitution because it would, in essence, deprive Mr. Gatzke of the opportunity to have a court determine what degree of responsibility Ms. Schaefer should have, what degree of responsibility he should have for the fact that Ms. Schaefer ended up with her daughter's money.
That had to do with the direction of proceeds from an insurance company.
Correct.
That the fact went to that Ms. Schaefer as opposed to Ms. Schaefer's daughter.
Correct. That money was paid out in $15,000 increments over time as living expenses for Ms. Schaefer through another oversight by my client.
Counsel? What I hear you arguing is that, yes, he's guilty of being a poor record keeper.
Undeniably.
But he is not guilty of intentionally and dishonestly taking advantage of his client.
I would rephrase the second thing slightly by saying the record in the case does not support, as not clearly erroneous, the findings that were made that he did intentionally take money from his client.
Well, thank you for that, because that was the third thing I was going to ask you. What other than the testimony of his client and himself and the referee deciding to believe one over the other supports the notion that there was no evidence to support intentional dishonesty?
That's
I mean,
what
tell me other than reweighing the testimony, what is it you're saying is missing?
I'll explain that right now. I don't ask that this court reweigh the testimony. I ask that someone weigh the testimony because it is apparent from the decision that the referee did not. There is no indication in the decision whatsoever that the referee weighed the evidence and came up to any conclusion. There's simply a conclusion. But the evidence on that subject is as follows.
I need you, as part of your answer, I need you to shore up for me how the referee could reach the result the referee did without believing the client.
I think the only explanation is that she believed the client. And the reason that's not, that is clearly erroneous, is following. Number one, what I've already said about Mr. Gatzke's testimony. With all its warts, all the wrongdoing, all the errors he admitted, no one ever was able to show that he was being untruthful. Number two, Mr. Gatzke consistently testified that although he didn't comply with the rules in providing all the written notices to Ms. Schaefer that he admitted he should have, as he now understands it, out of his mistakes, he orally discussed all of these things at length with Ms. Schaefer, that she was aware of them.
She disagrees with that, though, doesn't
yes,
she?
Yes, and I'm going to address that next. Ms. Schaefer is as bad a witness as ever existed in the history of the world. She achieved what trial lawyers call the hat trick several times. That's answering yes, no, and I don't know or I don't remember to the same question in a short period of time over and over again. She can't tell the same story the same way twice. And yet, without explanation, the referee accepted it. But there's more. There are at least four other witnesses that were clear from the record that would have had information relevant to the two crucial questions. What was said in the meetings that Mr. Gatzke said happened, and second of all, what was in Mr. Gatzke's files that are no longer available that would have buttressed what he said. Those four witnesses are the two daughters of Ms. Schaefer, the husband of one and the boyfriend of the other. The one daughter and her husband live in the same house as Ms. Schaefer. None of them were called by OLR. OLR furnished no explanation for why none of them were called. The referee, we argued to the referee, we argued to this court that it was appropriate to draw the inference that they weren't called, based on the record, they weren't called because their testimony would not have been favorable. No explanation was given by the referee as to why that inference wasn't even considered.
Why didn't you call them?
I can't call them. They all live in Nevada and Arizona. I couldn't call them at trial.
But they wouldn't come voluntarily. You could ask them to come.
Yes, in theory, I could have asked them to travel that distance and come. I frankly anticipated they would come.
Can't you take depositions outside the state?
Yes, we did take a deposition of Ms. Schaefer and one of the daughters. The OLR didn't offer any testimony from that daughter.
Are you familiar with more recent cases in this court that don't look with favor this missing witness or missing documents inference?
Don't look with favor doesn't mean they don't exist.
Well, if you read those opinions carefully, it would appear that the court thinks they don't exist.
I will disagree with that, but I think there's more to it, because this is not just missing documents. There were also witnesses who specifically described what was turned over to Ms. Schaefer that she didn't produce.
I know, but the court talked about witnesses who were not produced, and who, that there'd be an inference or presumption rebuttable as to what that means to the particular party, and the court said, hey, not true, you don't like it, don't do it.
Well, but I think this goes beyond that because of the fact that the testimony established, I think clearly, that extensive documentation was turned over to Ms. Schaefer and she didn't produce it when she claimed she did.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems is your client didn't have records too, but what your client couldn't produce records.
Because he turned them over to Ms. Schaefer.
But he couldn't even produce records of his own fees and his taking out fees.
Again, the testimony was, I think, essentially uncontradicted, except for Ms. Schaefer, that those were in the boxes that were turned over because Ms. Schaefer demanded them.
Counsel, since most of the counts deal with Ms. Schaefer, and since your view is Ms. Schaefer is not credible, but your client, who also had trouble with his testimony and not being consistent, your client is credible, despite the fact that the referee who saw both or heard both decided otherwise. So I decided to look at this case and say, okay, let's not even, we got 45 counts. You know, to revoke, we don't need 45 counts. To impose a serious sanction, we don't need 45 counts.
Agreed.
So, right?
Agreed.
So,
depends on the counts to some extent. It depends on the lawyer, but I agree.
Sure. So I just decided to look at the matters that don't involve Schaefer. Okay? So I looked at the Karen Zwissler matter. Right? And Mr. Gansky represented Karen, right?
Yes.
In an auto accident. And there was a claim settled and there was a contingent fee. I'm looking at page 47 of the referee report.
Okay.
And turns out, as you look at all these facts, and the referee made findings of fact appears as to each count and made conclusions of law as to each count.
Correct.
And these findings of facts, just taking the Zwissler matter, is Mr. Gansky took from this Zwissler money that he held, took more than he's entitled to for his fees, which left that short. And that he didn't pay her very rapidly, but paid himself, and paid himself more. And that he was doing in all of this, when you look at the Zwissler and the other matters, this is count 29, was that he used her funds for his own purposes. For more than he was entitled to by legal fees, and didn't hold the property of her in trust, and he engaged in dishonesty.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of what the gut issue there is.
So what this was the gut? I mean, I read right from her report.
I understand. The issue with regard to Zwissler and some of the other accounts is that at a point in time, as Mr. Gatsky testified, because he didn't realize how much money had been dispersed to Mrs. Schaefer, despite having received a warning from his staff that the money he thought was in the trust account for Ms. Schaefer's benefit was not as large as he thought it was, because, as he put it, he was stupid enough to think he knew better, that when it came time to issue checks for other clients, the money wasn't there, but it wasn't there because it hadn't been given to him. It was there because it had inadvertently given to Ms. Schaefer, and that when it was straightened out, the money was replaced at his expense because of the error with regard to the Schaefer account, and the Zwisslers were paid.
Well, as I read this, and I'm not talking about Schaefer, but we can, that what he's doing is he takes the money he gets from one for one client and puts it in his trust account, and then uses that money for his own fees, for other things, and then he's short, but he has another client who all of a sudden has large sums of money that he can put in his trust account. And so you've got client A, and he dips into client A's funds to pay X, and then he's short in A, but he gets client B trust account, and he uses B to pay off A, and then C to pay off B, and D to pay off C. And that's his method of doing business here.
I don't think that's a fair characterization, Justice Abrams said, for two reasons. First of all, you were speaking of it, as did the referee, as if there is a bank account for this client, there's a bank account for this client, there's a bank account for this client, and we're taking...
Isn't there such a bank account?
Because lawyers aren't required to do it, and no one does it. There is a single trust account into which all the money is deposited.
That's
and
right.
At the point in time when it was learned that the Schaefer funds had been overdrawn by a significant fund of money, and while it was attempted to be figured out what needed to be done to straighten this out, the payments to Zwistler and others came to be done. If you do the accounting, you say, okay, now we took this person's account because it was due to them and we used it, but that's not what happened. We didn't take money out of client A's account and put it into client B's account. When client B, A had to be paid, the client A was paid. The money was put in by Mr. Gatsky to make up the shortfall that had happened because of the error on the Schaefer account.
How long did Mr. Gatsky have the Zwistler money that was owed to Zwistler and he didn't pay it?
I couldn't tell you that off from my memory. There's too many accounts to remember every detail that way.
I can understand that, but the referee found that it was a long time and that was a violation, that he kept the money. In addition to that, if you have large amounts of money, isn't it recommended that you put them in separate accounts so that they bear interest rather than into a trust account?
Actually, I think the Supreme Court rules prefer that we leave it all in one account so it earns to the benefit of the IOLTA account. With what we do when we get significant amounts of money, which is infrequent in our trust account, but if we get something, say, in the six figures that will be there for any period of time, is we ask clients whether they want to have a separate account established. In all honesty, with the kind of interest you get in recent years, it's not worth the paperwork.
I know that, but things change.
Yes.
They were high interest rates, low interest rates, nothing to speak about interest rates, and maybe they'll go back to higher interest rates.
But no one has, there is no count here that alleges that Mr. Gatsky acted improperly by putting all the money in his single IOLTA account.
I agree to that. But there are counts that he used money that should have been attributed to one client for another.
And I would suggest that that is done simply by counting the chain. There is no evidence that he physically took money from one client and gave it to the other. This is an accounting issue rather than a factual issue. Mr. Gatsky took the fees out in the beginning because the fees could be paid to him because he had earned his money in the Zwistler case. He didn't realize there was a shortage. There were delays in several of these cases for reasons Mr. Gatsky described in his testimony at trial about resolving liens and other issues. It is not unusual in a personal injury case to have money sitting in a lawyer's trust account for extended periods of time because of the difficulty in working out subrogation liens and similar matters.
But he took more than his legal fees to which he was entitled.
In that instance, that's what the referee found, and I can't say it's clearly erroneous. We disagree, but that's beside the point, I guess, at this point.
I want to return you to the very beginning when you were discussing the findings and conclusions of the referee and describing them as clearly erroneous. And you claimed that Ms. Schaefer's testimony was not credible and Gatsky's was credible. How can the court second-guess that? That's where we kind of started. You had a couple of responses. I note in looking at the non-Schaefer counts and conclusions, there were findings and conclusions as to these other clients that your clients' comments were untruthful, misleading, and dishonest. So even taking Schaefer away, we've got those kinds of findings and conclusions with regard to the others. So you've talked about the missing inferences drawn from the missing witness instruction. You've indicated why you can show they're clearly erroneous by no one showed he was untruthful. And so give me some more help on that, because I think this goes to the guts of your case.
Well, in our brief, we've itemized the many, many instances in which Ms. Schaefer was simply incapable of testifying in any meaningful way in support of these allegations that were then accepted. Again, it's in 30 minutes, 25 minutes of which I've already used, it's very difficult to go through each and every instance and explain to you where they are. I can tell you, I don't think the referee found that he was dishonest in statements he made to clients. What she found is that because of the problem that Justice Abramson just indicated, where there wasn't money in the trust account, there was a period of time where clients weren't being paid because there were no funds there.
One of the findings was with regard to the OLR investigation, misleading and untruthful were the findings.
And Mr. Gatzke testified in his hearing testimony that he had made a mistake in one of the statements he had made to OLR. But as he pointed out, and it was clear from the examination we made of the investigator for OLR at the hearing, Mr. Gatzke was questioned on numerous occasions about matters going back many, many years of many, many different matters, submitted many written statements. In all honesty, if he only got one wrong, he did pretty darn good. He did better than I would have done under the circumstances. And to tar him as a liar because he erred in one point, I think, is more illuminating than harmful to my client. I would like to reserve at least a minute or two for rebuttal, so unless there are other questions.
You still have time. After the red light comes on, you'll have five more minutes.
Okay. In essence, what we have asked the court to do is to examine the findings. If upon examination of the findings, you conclude that they are not clearly erroneous, I guess to a large extent we're done here. I don't think that's a reasonable conclusion. I don't think it's consistent with the kind of analysis that, for example, was done in the Ballastieri case. But if you find they are clearly erroneous, then what we believe this case presents is a multiple situation of violations that do not involve dishonesty, with perhaps one or two exceptions, that fit within the three or four cases we've cited in our brief, which are all lawyers with multiple occasions of multiple rule violations, some of which involve dishonesty, most of which do not, lawyers who had, in some cases, multiple prior histories of disciplinary matters and yet got private reprimands or suspensions below 6 months. What we've proposed and believe is warranted under the facts is a five-month suspension. The time frame, the reason for that suggestion is obvious, and I don't need to belabor the point for you, I'm sure, that would enable Mr. Gatzke to return to the practice of law at some point. With monitoring of his trust account, Mr. Gatzke would be the first one to tell you he needs help with his trust account. He's not good at it. And to have him go through the process of attempting to return to a life that has in every other respect been a model, helpful service life, both as a lawyer, as a public servant, and working in other things. Thank you,
counsel. You have 5 minutes in the bottle.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Schwarzenbart. I have the honor of representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this matter here today. I believe there's an agreement that the principal issue this court faces on review in this disciplinary proceeding is whether the referee's findings of fact as to the conversion claims which are being challenged on appeal are clearly erroneous under the court's standards of review. The first order of business is, what are the standards of review? They've been cited in our brief. I won't repeat them in detail here, but as to the findings of fact, the clearly erroneous test in the Phelps case, this court stated, a finding of fact is clearly erroneous if it is against the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. In the Cogswell case, which takes us back to the late 70s, this court said, to command a reversal under the great weight and clear preponderance standard, the evidence in support of a contrary finding must itself constitute the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. So what that burden imposes on Mr. Gatzke on his appeal is to show that the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence is in his favor, and that he was not dishonest in his dealings with clients with regard to how he ran his trust account. As we've stated in our brief, there are 18 conversion counts in this case, and I tried to keep track of the ones that were conceded as not contested. I think that the implication is there may be some other ones that are contested, but in Mr. Gatzke's brief, the thrust of his argument was to attack the findings of conversion. We set out in our brief, we classified the conversion findings into basically five different categories. There are the Patricia Schaefer conversions, there's the conversions of other clients' funds because of the fact that there were payments made to Ms. Schaefer, and there were payments made by Mr. Gatzke for the condominium project, which he owned out of trust account funds, which he charged to Ms. Schaefer, even though she didn't have any money in the account anymore. There's conversions related to the proceeds of sale regarding the Coffee Road property, which was one of the real estate investments. There's a series of conversions resulting from the overdraft after the Zwistler funds were finally paid after they had sat in the trust account for more than 8 months. And then there's a final set of conversions which have nothing to do with Schaefer. And what they illustrate is how Mr. Gatzke ran his trust account and the lack of respect he had for client funds. Now, before we talk about conversion, I think it's appropriate to readdress what does this court mean when it refers to an attorney converting client funds. The Mulligan case recently decided by this court reminded us of what the different types of conversions are. They include the unauthorized use of clients' funds for the lawyer's own purposes. And in Mulligan, this court stated that conversion includes temporary use. In other words, if a lawyer borrows money from the trust account for a personal purpose and then pays it back later on, that's still a conversion. Paying one client out of money due to another is conversion. That the court has referred to that as robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I think there's no dispute in this case that those types of conversions did occur. Those are just some of the things that in Mulligan this court referred to as conversions. The Mulligan case cited the Weigel case, which in turn cited the ABA BNA Lawyer's Manual on Professional Conduct. These standards basically repeat what has long been the law regarding a lawyer's basic duties with respect to client trust funds. And it's true. We have IALTA trust accounts in which the funds of multiple clients are put into one account. There's a reason for that. It eases management. It eases the costs. But there's regulations that come along with an IALTA trust account, and one of them is that while client funds are not literally segregated into different bank accounts, they are supposed to be segregated on paper, and the funds of one client are supposed to be used only for the purposes related to that client. That's why the trust account rules require monthly balancing statements and client ledgers to be maintained. So that
the theme that I see and hear and read in Mr. Johnson's material is nobody got hurt.
Well, that's not true.
Well, that everybody got what was due him or her. I'm not so sure about Schaefer, but at least everyone else. They got back what they were supposed to get back, maybe a little late, maybe there wasn't full accounting, but man, no one is hurt, so why do you call it conversion?
Well, there's $550,000 that the OLR has asked and that the referee recommended be paid in restitution.
To
half of that roughly to Patricia Schaefer and half of that roughly to her daughter. The rest of the clients eventually were made whole because on these conversions, they weren't paid back their own funds. They were paid back from other clients' funds or from Mr. Gatsky's funds, which he commingled in the trust account and which he admits commingled.
How many clients are we talking about other than Schaefer?
We're talking about approximately somewhere between 5 and 10 clients, Your Honor. I can go through those as in my argument here today.
So you're saying there are 5 to 10 clients other than Schaefer?
5 to 10 that were identified in the complaint, and then there was count 37 identified, I think, a dozen more clients, which were, I won't call them de minimis, but they were much smaller amounts that Mary Heft Smith, the OLR's trust account administrator, had grouped together into one conversion count when she attempted to trace whose monies were being used for what purpose.
5 to 10 that were worth talking about.
That were the named ones, yes.
When it comes to restitution, what in this record supports the dollar figure awarded?
The testimony of Mary Heft Smith and Exhibit 79, which summarized the restitution claim, itemized those amounts, and I can turn to that. That's sort of at the back end of my argument, but I can go there. The claim with respect to Ms. Schaefer's daughter is fairly simple, and that is there was the Jackson National Life Insurance policy in which Amy Schaefer, who was the biological daughter of Patricia Schaefer and her husband who committed suicide, Stephen Wiederholt, Amy was 13 or 14 years old.
Let me just interrupt you a little bit. Rather than going into the individual facts of it, I guess part of my concern is if this were decided in a civil proceeding, there would be the opportunity to present defenses and then a conclusion reached as to the amount that was due and owing. Sometimes that's the right way to go about making a restitution determination. What in this record, I guess what I'm asking you is, what in this record supports the idea that the defenses to the amount of restitution ordered were considered by the referee?
I'm going to, before I answer that, Justice Ziegler, I'm going to allude to the OLR policies, which this court has discussed in some prior cases, because I think that's kind of what you're getting to. There were, I think, four factors which the OLR considers. One of them is whether the rights of parties in a collateral proceeding will be prejudiced. There is no collateral proceeding. There was no lawsuit filed by the Schaefers. The funds restored do not constitute incidental or consequential damages, and in this case, the argument is that these are direct damages. They were in the respondent lawyer's control. The funds were in his trust account. And finally, they are reasonably ascertainable.
Let me just question you a little bit on that. I'm thinking of a criminal case where you have restitution that needs to be ordered, but the parties, there may be an admission that there was a wrongdoing, but there is not an agreement about the amount that ought to be ordered by the court. Then the court has a restitution hearing, which is kind of like a mini civil trial, and reaches a conclusion after hearing all of the claims and the defenses, and then bases the order on that. Is that what happened here?
I think that record does support that type of evidentiary exploration, Your Honor, because if I can quickly address the numbers, with Amy Schaefer, it's relatively easy. The insurance lawsuit was settled for $325,000, roughly. The day in which the money was received into Mr. Gatsky's trust account, he paid his law firm $50,000. OLR assumed that that was a reasonable fee for the representation and the insurance dispute. So basically, the OLR's position is Amy Schaefer should have gotten those insurance proceeds. She didn't. She should get $325,000 in change minus the $50,000 for an attorney's fee. That's how you arrive at the figure that was recommended for Amy Schaefer. The Patricia Schaefer amount is a bit more complicated. But those numbers were ascertainable, and they're supported in the record. Ms. Smith, when she reconstructed the trust account records from the bank records which had been obtained, and these are part, these were stipulated to. The bank records were stipulated into the record. There's no dispute regarding the numbers in the bank records. Ms. Smith came up with $433,000 roughly of misappropriations of Schaefer money from what are referred to as the air accounts. There was $352,000 roughly from the sale of the Coffee Road parcels, which Mr. Gatzke could not account as going back to Ms. Schaefer. Those properties had been purchased with Ms. Schaefer's money. They were sold. $352,000 of that money did not go back to Ms. Schaefer. Subtracted from that were $225,000, and this consists of the funny thing about this case, Your Honors, is this is not part of the referee's findings, but the appearance here is almost that Mr. Gatzke became an investment firm for Ms. Schaefer. In other words, she gave him control over about $3.75 million of insurance proceeds, and she was getting a monetary stream out of that investment, so to speak. She was getting $15,000 a month, which Mr. Gatzke was sending her. And he continued to send her $15,000 a month through 2009. Some of that money, by the OLR's calculation, and we think this is clear in the record from the bank records and the investment records, $225,000 of that can be traced to the insurance money that should have gone to Amy. So we're taking that out of the money that's due to Patricia Schaefer. There's other money that was paid by Gatzke to Ms. Schaefer out of the trust account from other clients' money after he had run out of Schaefer's money in the account. That money is subtracted because Ms. Schaefer did get this money. That's $178,000. And then there's $104,000 and roughly just under $2,000 of money that went into the trust account that looked like law firm money. So the OLR's computation of the restitution due to Patricia Schaefer is based on the bank records and the trust account records, which are not in dispute. They were put into the record. The argument was made. The testimony was presented to the referee, and her recommendation as to restitution was based upon all of those objective records.
Counsel, you say the easier of the two restitution claims asserted here is the claim of Amy, and you gave a way to arrive at an ascertainable amount. What I recall reading from in preparation, though, when I read the briefs, is that your opposing counsel doesn't agree as to who should be responsible for that. Is there some kind of, I don't remember if it was unjust enrichment, and perhaps a lawsuit, your opposing counsel, I recall, indicating may be brought against the mother and also Attorney Gatzke. So here, I think they're asserting not so much the amount that might be due Amy, but who's responsible for it. Is my recollection of the arguments essentially correct? And if it is, how can we decide that here today?
I think the argument is that he's essentially blaming Patricia Schaefer for the fact that he stole Amy's money, which I think is a preposterous proposition. What happened in this case is the money went into Mr. Gatzke's trust account in April of 2007. His duty to his client, Amy Schaefer, and this is a conflict of interest, and that's why I think it's notable in the referee's report. The referee states that revocation in this case could be based on just the conflict of interest. And that's because in representing two people who were potentially competing claimants it was a $500,000 life insurance policy, he needed to get their consent in writing, informed consent to that conflict, and get spelled out in writing who was entitled to that money between Patricia Schaefer and Amy Schaefer. And this problem is exacerbated by the fact that Mr. Gatzke, prior to the lawsuit being filed, the insurance lawsuit back in 2007, he was asserting that Amy was the beneficiary. When he was investigated by OLR, he made a number of statements such as, there was no Amy money. This was Patricia Schaefer's money. Then suddenly at trial, it was Amy Schaefer's money again. Let me turn to the issue of the trust account. In April of 2007, the insurance money goes into the trust account. Mr. Gatzke should have seen to it that this minor got that money into a proper segregated account at that very moment. Instead, it went into the bottomless pit of his trust account to pay his mortgage payments to North Shore Bank. That's what happened to the money. It went to Mr. Gatzke's real estate investment.
Now, I gather that he didn't have this GAL dealing with this and getting court approval.
That's correct. There was no GAL appointed. I think everybody in that case simply assumed Mr. Gatzke was taking care of this in his office when he was not taking care of it. But I want to turn, I think, to the principal argument here. Counsel is inviting this court, essentially, I think, to retry this case as a case of Patricia Schaefer versus James Gatzke. OLR will concede that Patricia Schaefer was not a good witness. She was not an educated woman. She had a high school education. She needed help from Mr. Gatzke's office paying her bills after her husband passed away. That's undisputed. And I would invite the court just to look at the trust account ledger for Ms. Schaefer to see the type of payments that she had to have the law firm make on her behalf. And by the way, she paid for those services out of her funds. She couldn't even pay her daughter's tuition. She needed to have the law firm take care of that.
Really need to have the law firm do that? Was that just something that he picked up and did? He could say, oh, it won't cause you any bother, I'll take care of it.
I think the testimony was that, and Mr. Gatzke admitted, she needed help paying her bills. And they paid her bills. And he billed her for paying her bills.
I find it extraordinary that a woman with a high school education could not pay her daughter's tuition.
I think, Your Honor, the record would support a finding that Ms. Schaefer was extraordinarily helpless, which makes the failure to obtain written informed consent to these real estate investments all the more egregious.
Mr. Schwartz, part of the allegations here is that Ms. Schaefer asked Mr. Gatzke to ensure that her name did not appear on any of the instruments of ownership. Is that disputed?
She didn't admit to that. Mr. Gatzke supplied a letter to her back from 2006 where he made that assertion. That's the only evidence in this
record. The reason she didn't want her name to appear on those instruments of ownership is so that any creditors out there of her deceased husband would not find out about any assets that they could possibly come after to claim debts on. That's the allegation.
And, Your Honor, I'm not going to sit here today and dispute that there may have been some conversation way back in 2005 or 2006 where Ms. Schaefer expressed paranoia about her assets being found and may have expressed some of those concerns. But the point I was going to make, Your Honor, is I think that if, in fact, these types of conversations occurred with a woman who was a high school graduate who couldn't pay her own bills and had come on to millions of dollars of insurance company, if there ever was a case.
Mr. Schwarzenberg, please, just sure. One second. Some of the wealthiest, most sophisticated business people I've ever had the privilege of knowing are people who graduated from high school and went no further. I'm not saying I have no idea what Ms. Schaefer's story is, other than what I've read in this record, but I don't think the fact that she had a high school, in fact, one of them had an eighth grade education.
Well, I can assure you she did not go on to found Microsoft or Apple. She worked as a dental assistant and a clerk, I think.
My point is, and where we were going, I thought, on the track was, I made that observation in regard to the assertion that she wanted her name off of the instruments of ownership as sort of a, my memory was jogged on that when you were talking about how unsophisticated she was and how she couldn't manage to write out a check to a school to pay tuition. which I, as a Chief Justice, in one of her questions, I mean, I certainly wonder, too, it's not uncommon for people with money to pay others to handle their, what the rest of us just view as the regular incidents of life, you know, the minor inconveniences of paying our bills. So I don't know. Is there anything in the record to indicate that she was incapable of doing these things, or she just viewed it as a convenience that she was willing to pay for?
There is something in the there is testimony in the record regarding that, and in fact, I think Mr. Gatzke told the OLR investigators that he considered Ms. Schaefer to be unsophisticated back in 2005 when he first undertook managing her money. But the point I was trying to make, Judge, was 1.8A requires attorneys to get written informed consent from clients when they engage in investments with a client. And if there ever was a case that really required written informed consent so we wouldn't be here today, this would be such a case.
Is that true even if the person has a power of attorney?
Well, the power of attorney in this case was a limited power of attorney that was originally given. It was not a general power of attorney.
But what was its limitations?
The original power of attorney was limited to the probate of the estate of Mr. Wiederholt. That was the original power of attorney. There was a general power of attorney given later, but I would question whether or not an attorney taking a general power of attorney over a client's money, even in those circumstances, would not be required to get some type of written notice equivalent to 1.8A, where they would be advised to consult with another lawyer.
Well, as I read Mr. Johnson's brief, or Mr. Gatzke, he concedes that they didn't get a waiver. He concedes that you don't have a good record here, necessarily, of bookkeeping, accounting, waivers, discussion of all of this, getting consent, but that these are technical and procedural matters, and that those are for to be used for the 5 months. I mean, he's conceding that there were enough goofs on the part of Mr. Gatzke that he deserves 5 months. And he attributes that. And when I read it, and I never could figure out from the main brief of Mr. Gatzke what the goofs were that deserved 5 months. And in the reply brief, there's only one goof that he can talk about, what appears to reveal. So he never states what's deserving of 5 months, so I don't know what's deserving of more.
Well, I can move on to what the OLR believes is deserving of more than 5 months, Your Honor, because the whole talk about Ms. Schaefer versus Mr. Gatzke, I believe, is simply a straw man defense. Ms. Schaefer is being said, this case is being postured as, if you believe Mr. Gatzke, this court should believe Mr. Gatzke, even though the referee didn't. And if you do that and you disbelieve Ms. Schaefer, well, then he was honest. The record does not support that framing of the issues. I would direct the court's attention in looking at that, first of all, to conversions that had nothing to do with Ms. Schaefer or her money. There was the Rife matter, which is count 40 in the complaint. In that case, Mr. Gatzke, on May 21 of 2007, paid his law firm's mortgage payment out of the trust account. He paid his law firm's mortgage payment out of the trust account. He told the OLR he was paying that out of fees, that he kept his fees in the trust account. Now, if that was true, and you could believe that was true, maybe that's just a technical violation of somebody who's claiming to be ignorant of trust account rules, although I don't believe Mr. Gatzke is ignorant. What the records show was that the settlement proceeds in the Rife case didn't come till 10 days later. Mr. Gatzke basically borrowed money, client's money in the trust account, to pay his law firm's mortgage. That is conversion.
What is that mortgage for?
For the law firm building.
Okay.
on the law firm building. And this is it's stipulated. That's what the money was used for. He made payments on behalf of Azron out of the trust account. Azron was a business formed by Mr. Gatzke and his members of his firm for purposes of running a gas station. He made payments on behalf of Azron out of the trust account when Azron didn't have any money in the trust account. Again, he was borrowing client monies to pay personal obligations using client funds. Regarding Ms. Schaefer, I would direct the court's attention to that part of our brief where we have outlined the use of Ms. Schaefer's money that Mr. Gatzke transferred into the so-called heir accounts. There was virtually no money in those accounts when he transferred $300,000 of Schaefer's money into the accounts in September of 2005.
Was there an estate proceeding at all?
For Mr. Wiederholt?
Yes.
I believe there was, yes.
And was that closed that quickly?
I think the estate proceeding had nothing to do with the money. Ms. Schaefer got insurance money, which passed outside the estate. So that's how the money... There was a lawsuit going on that had been started against her husband. They reached a partial settlement. $2.5 million was transferred. That was Ms. Schaefer's original share. That was transferred to Mr. Gatzke's trust account. And literally within days of receiving that money, $300,000 of that went into this heir account. And immediately after that, Mr. Gatzke paid $10,000 of it to his wife. And then he paid his back taxes of $10,000. Back taxes going back to 1999, why he's using Ms. Schaefer's money to pay his back taxes, why, that certainly seems to be a dishonest use of client funds.
Doesn't he cover all that by saying, well, I was getting fees from Ms. Schaefer. I was doing a lot of stuff and getting fees.
The exhibits 10 and 11 in the record are the invoices that were sent, and they show that he was fully paid on his fees from the trust account at that time. In addition, he and his partner, Mr. Ruppelt, arranged to have $15,000 each wired to a casino in Las Vegas out of Ms. Schaefer's money, which had been transferred into this heir account. Your Honors, there is a load of improper disbursements of Ms. Schaefer's money. Mary Heft Smith of the OLR painstakingly went through the bank records for all of these accounts. Exhibit 73 was her effort to trace the wrongful disbursements out of monies that went from the trust account into the heir account, and there was testimony about whether those expenditures were for personal purposes or for purposes of Ms. Schaefer, and the expenditures which were not for Ms. Schaefer are the ones which are the subject of the conversion claims involving Ms. Schaefer's money. And then lastly, particularly egregious, counts 16 and 17, Mr. Gatzke continued to make disbursements and from the trust account and charge them against Ms. Schaefer after he had run out of her money. And that included disbursements which he charged to Ms. Schaefer that were made once again to Azra, this personal venture. He made the mortgage payments on North Oak, which he owned with his wife. He made the mortgage payments out of the trust account and charged them to Ms. Schaefer, even though he no longer had any of Ms. Schaefer's money. We would submit that the record in this case amply supports the referee's findings. Mr. Gatzke cannot possibly show the referee's findings of dishonesty that support these conversion claims are clearly erroneous under the court's standards of review based on the cases we've discussed relative to the sanction. We believe this case does fall squarely within the revocation line of cases that we've cited in our brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
I have a question for you. If you took out all of the Schaefer matters, what do you have left and what kind of sanction would that support?
Well, if you take out all the Schaefer matters, you still have the Rife conversions. You have the Azron conversions. You have the overdraft and the conversions of client funds that resulted from that. And even if that money was eventually paid back, what we had was hundreds of thousands of dollars of clients' money that was being misused, that was at risk. And so I think that even if you take out all the Schaefer stuff, this is clearly more than a six-month suspension case. It's probably more in line with the 18-month, two-year suspension cases, I would think, at minimum.
Aren't you looking for revocation?
Well, the OLR is looking for revocation, and that is to a certain extent predicated on the Schaefer wrongdoing. It's basically, if one looks at the complaint in this case, the first 28 counts are either directly or indirectly related to the Schaefer funds and the trust account violations resulting from the mismanagement of the Schaefer investments. The last 17 counts are other forms of trust account misconduct, some of which are also both the overdraft conversions and the RIF and the ASRAM conversions.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Your Honors.
A lot to talk about in 5 minutes. Let me just touch a couple of high points. Number one, the computation of the restitution allegedly owed to Mr. Schaefer. The problem with that, as we pointed out in our brief, is that it assumes that the Coffee Road investment represented a theft by Mr. Gatzke. And if there was a subject on which Mrs. Schaefer was particularly unhelpful, it was on her claim that she didn't know that they had invested in Coffee Road and that they then decided to sell the Coffee Road investment and invest that money in the condominium project, which is exactly what Mr. Gatzke had to say. We don't believe the evidence supports that as an element of restitution because that money was invested with her consent under the evidence. If you take that out, she's not entitled to any money at all. On the
records that show that the referee took that into consideration?
I don't know that it shows anywhere. I don't know that the referee commented on how the referee was coming up with that number. That's the way OLR presented it, and she adopted the numbers. I think the inference is that she adopted OLR's thinking. On the restitution for the claim by the daughter, we are not claiming this is Mrs. Schaefer's fault. What we are saying is that Mrs. Schaefer got the money. The assertion that Mr. Gatzke got the money from the minor's account is just not true. It's not supported by the record. That money, by their own admission, the great majority of it went directly to the mother. So the question that we would raise on restitution under the collateral proceedings factor is it appropriate for you to order restitution, or is it appropriate for a civil court to decide how much of the return of any proceeds that are owed to Ms. Schaefer should come from Mr. Gatzke, and how much should come from the mother, since she's the one who got all or virtually all of the money. Third, the comment that the referee thought that the conflict of interest issue alone would justify revocation, I think shows how far afield the referee got from the law. There isn't a single case cited by OLR. There's not a case you've ever decided that would say that all you looked at was the conflict of interest allegation that was raised here, that would warrant revocation. Shows, again, it's more illuminating about the referee's attitude than it is about what the result should be here. If all we had was that conflict of interest allegation in handling the Jackson Life proceeding, that would be worthy of, I would think, a private reprimand, certainly no more than a public reprimand, and yet the referee offered the comment that would support revocation. Next, I believe counsel misspoke. There was court approval of the minor settlement. There wasn't a guardian ad litem. I can't explain why. Nobody else raised it either. That's usually something defendants raise in these proceedings, that they want to make sure the settlement is valid. For whatever reason, nobody raised it, but it was submitted to the court. The court ordered what be done about this, so it was approved by the court. Next, there is zero evidence that Mrs. Schaefer needed help to pay her bills. Absolutely none. She asked for help. She hired a lawyer to do it for her, and as has been pointed out by several of the questions, that's her right. Wouldn't be the way I'd spend my money, but that's how she did it. But nobody ever offered any testimony that she was incapable of paying the bills, as opposed to saying she thought she was a wealthy lady who didn't have to deal with that kind of trivia. In fact, the testimony from Mr. Gatzke was that although he thought at the beginning she was relatively unsophisticated, his opinion about her changed over time, and he offered specifically testimony that when he decided they had to go to China to investigate the allegations against her husband. A brief side visit here. Her husband was essentially broke when he died. He was being sued for having embezzled millions of dollars from a partner who invested in a Chinese investment, a Chinese factory to make tile, as I recall, and that because he was being sued, he tried to murder his partner. Why, this was in the papers, he poisoned a ice cream treat from McDonald's and brought it over to his partner's house and got him to eat it, and he got sick and went to the hospital and found he'd been poisoned. So their financial affairs were in disarray. There were lots of reasons for Mr. Gatzke and Ms. Schaefer to be very concerned about people bringing lawsuits. There was a bizarre lawsuit brought about this insurance, for these insurance proceeds. But in the middle of all that, they had to go to China to investigate this tile lawsuit. And Mrs. Schaefer, according to Mr. Gatzke's testimony, not rebutted by anybody, had a very encyclopedic knowledge of her husband's business affairs in China, could tell them exactly where they should go, exactly who they should talk to in China. And that's what they based their trip on. And when they went there, he testified, the people, she said, would be knowledgeable about what was going on in this tile investment that was still pending at the time, turned out to be correct. So this idea that she's this poor, foolish little airhead lady who can't pay her bills and is too dumb to understand any of this is just simply contrary to the great evidence in the record. Commingling funds. Mr. Gatzke testified that when he found out that, in fact, his account manager was correct, Ms. Schaefer didn't have as much money in the account, he put his own money in the account to make sure clients would get paid. That's the legally wrong thing to do. I find it very hard to find fault with Mr. Gatzke for immediately taking his own money and putting it in the account to make certain clients were being taken care of. But again, that's what we've gotten here. One final thought. If OLR is right, here's what happened. Mr. Gatzke lived a life for a long time before he went to law school. No one has ever accused him of doing a dishonest or wrongful thing in his life. He was involved in civic affairs. He was the mayor of New Berlin. He did many things. He was in real estate, other investments. He went to law school. He practiced law for years and years and years, and no one has ever suggested he did a thing wrong. Never stole any money from anybody, never did a dishonest act. And one day, he went nuts. And he started on this reign of terror, stealing money from everyone he could get. That's what they and the referee concluded. Mr. Gatzke said, what happened is this. I never handled a trust account before. The practice I was in didn't involve trust account funds. I stupidly thought I understood how to do this, and I could not have been more wrong.
I thought that there was something in the record. Excuse me. I think the time's up.
Yeah, the red light is on.
Time's up. That's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for a difficult and complicated case. And your briefs were very helpful to us, as were your arguments. So thank you again. We are adjourned, and the court will reconvene in closed conference at 1:30.